Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 505. And today I'm joined by Brandon Cronenberg. Dear Lord, was I excited for this one. And dear Lord, did it deliver. I'm a big fan of Brandon Cronenberg. Some of you will have heard a couple of years back, 2020, in my films of the year, I stumbled upon a screening of his, at that point, brand new release, Possessor, and it blew me away. And then you will also have heard all the talk at the moment about Infinity Pool. I don't know if you watch a lot of things on Netflix, a lot of the stuff I watch, it was getting advertised, not on Netflix, on YouTube, a lot of the stuff I watch, it was getting advertised on there. There's a lot of talk about it because of how bonkers it is, and we get into that. I think we pretty much avoid spoilers, certainly nothing more than the trailer, but go and watch the trailer, it's bonkers. But it's Alexander Skarsgård, it's Mia Goth, it's amazing. I really enjoyed it. Spoiler alert, I think it might get into my films of the year. So that's obviously huge news for Brandon if he's listening. And Brandon is, of course, the son of David Cronenberg, absolute icon of cinema as well. So yeah, we had a good chat. We go deep on some stuff, man. I found out some things I didn't know about his filmmaking process, and I proper loved it. I was catching up with my brother just after this, and I did not. I basically repeated this whole podcast that you're about to hear to my brother about 30 minutes after we stopped recording. But you get to listen to it in its true form. We're brought to you as ever by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's where you can get all my merch and stuff. And patreon.com/ScroobiusPip is where you can support the podcast for like a dollar or so a month, a dollar or two a month. And that helps pay the bills. Yeah, I've not got anything else to tell you about, man. Let's just get on with the podcast. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 505, with the wonderful Mr. Brandon Cronenberg. Right, I'm here today with Brandon Cronenberg. I start every one of these episodes asking how you are, but it's a more important question with this chat, because if you're good, then we're about to talk about some mind-bending cinema. But if you're not good, I'm really worried about the films you're making, man. So how are you? Is everything okay?
I'm medium.
You're medium. Okay, that's a good middle ground.
No, I'm good. Listen, I'm in Berlin right now. We just premiered the film for the EU premiere. It was a really lovely experience. I've never been here before to the city even or to the festival. And yeah,
it's beautiful in Berlin, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I haven't had a chance to really see the city yet, but the festival has been great. The crowd was incredible. And yeah, it feels really nice. On the other hand, I'm a curmudgeonly pessimistic hermit, and so I'm never good exactly, but you know.
Man, I do a weekly podcast and record it from my living room, so I completely understand the curmudgeonly hermit side of things.
I'm jealous of your beard, basically, is what I'm saying.
It's all right at the moment. I've got to start off by thanking you because back in 2020, I was shooting a TV show for NBC in Vancouver, peak pandemic, where we're filming for 7 months and I was isolating for the majority of that. But on one of the breaks from isolation, the first thing I wanted to do was to get into the cinema. It was all I wanted. I adore being in the cinema, but I wanted to go in the daytime so it was quiet and wear a mask still because there's still a production to protect. And the film I saw that was on was a film called Possessor. I hadn't seen any trailers. I didn't go off anything other than the artwork. So I went in and watched Possessor with no human contact for 2 weeks in a new country with a slightly fuzzy head. And by God, was it the perfect scenario to stumble into. I honestly think that's the perfect way to watch that film. I loved it. So yeah, thank you for that. It made it into my films of the year immediately. And it was that perfect... I've missed cinema. I've missed the journey that you can go on in a dark room with a big screen and big sound. And the films you make, I do feel, sounds obvious, but the visuals and the audio are really key. So being in a dark room with a good system really affects that. So,
thank you. That's incredibly kind of you. I feel very fortunate that the context really biased you in favor of enjoying our film. So, that's very kind. Thanks.
It's beautiful though, man. I'm a big believer in going into films as blind as possible. So I kind of want to know how you find promoting your films, because I think your films in particular really benefit from people going in without knowing too much. So how is it to promote these things? Because you don't want to give much away. You don't want to ruin anything. So it must be tough to discuss the films at times because you want people to experience it fresh, right?
Yeah, it's a very tricky balance. I mean, discussing them after the films come out, doing press is one thing, because people can just decide whether they want to hear me ramble on, you know, like an idiot about my films. I think the trickier balance is sort of trailers and you know, it's always a discussion between distributors and directors and a kind of pointed of tension often, because they have the perspective and they're right that they want to get as many people to see the film as possible. And as a director, you should want that too, which you should. As a director, you also work very hard trying to surprise people and create this sort of unexpected experience. And you know, with a certain type of filmmaking, that's kind of at the core of what it is creatively. So yeah, you instinctively as a director want people to go in blind. Certainly that's the best way to see Infinity Pool, I would think. But it's so hard to cut through the noise right now. I mean, there's so much being made, you know, the streaming content wars, there's so much available on the internet. It's so hard to get any sort of attention. So there are certain plot aspects, for instance, where, you know, it's been an ongoing discussion. How much do you reveal? You know, there's something early on in the film that changes everything. And that's designed to be a surprise, but that's also become the main point of the trailer and the main, you know, discussion point. If I had my way, people would see the film without knowing that. But on the other hand, my distributors were absolutely right to push to include that in the conversation, because it was a hook that got people excited about the film. And just getting people out to theaters, getting people to see your film in the first place is such a struggle. So yeah, I don't know what the right answer is. It's just a question of feeling out how do you generate interest in a film.
It's such a balancing act, isn't it? Before I moved into acting, I was a musician for years, and that was always the balancing act there, having the promo team and people wanting to do radio edits and stuff like that. And you have that kind of battle of, right, I've made this album I'm really proud of, but if we don't do a radio edit of this single, it won't get played on the radio, so I can't get people to hear the album. But the radio edit isn't what I want people to have their impression of. And trailers are the prime example of that. The film that made me stop watching trailers was the second of the more of Dark Knight Rises. Was it Dark Knight Rises? The one that had the amazing scene with Bane in this football stadium, all that. And that was in the trailer because it's an amazing scene and it will draw people in. But then when you go and see the film, the biggest, most astounding part, something that you've watched 30 times in the build-up. So
right, yeah.
It's an odd balance.
It's a tricky balance, and there's no right answer. You know, I think ultimately, if you're somebody who doesn't want to know, hopefully you're just kind of avoiding this stuff and preserving it for yourself. But again, it's so hard to get people out to see anything. So I'm, you know, as a director, I hate it, but as a director who also wants people to see his movies, I completely sympathize with the impulse.
And there's some really attention-grabbing visuals in Infinity Pool in particular. So there is certain things like, I want to hold this off, but if people just see a glimpse of this, they're going to go, I need to know what the fuck's going on there. With both Possessor and Infinity Pool, you're looking at bodies and brains and consciousness and kind of what makes us us. What is it that fascinates you about these topics and subjects to delve into and play with and explore?
I mean, I think, you know, in narrative art, in art in general, in film, quite often the impulse in making it is to explore what it is to be a human being. You know, it's to explore our perspective, what it is to be us. That's not just true of science fiction films. It's not just true of, you know, sort of high, quote unquote, high concept films. You know, a simple drama is usually very much about human experience, who we are and how we process our experiences. So for me, I guess my version of that is often to do with brains, you know, the sort of format of being a human being, on an essential level, that's interesting to me. But I think it's so much of film is some version of that. You know what I mean? I think that's
yeah, of course.
What we tend to be drawn to when we write, you know, maybe vainly we tend to write about ourselves, but also, you know, we're processing things subjectively, and so you can't really totally escape that.
Yeah, I love that, and I think it's a fascinating subject, because the way it's approached in both of these films, it's really interesting, the divide between religion and science. And I'm not a religious person at all, but in reading up on things, it's that realization that religion at least tries to explain what science can't, and that is the kind of the idea of a soul or an essence or whatever else, and that is touched upon in both of these films. And I think it's done really beautifully. Like, I don't currently do any drugs, but in my youth I like to experiment with a lot of different things, and hallucinogens were a big part of that, and it really changed how my mind is now, I think. And there's a lot of studies going on in America and a lot of movements in America at the moment to change the laws around hallucinogens for therapeutic purposes. There's big things going on where people are having two or three therapies, guided therapy sessions on hallucinogens, and it's helping them with PTSD and having all sorts of breakthroughs. I guess kind of all this to say that I think you managed to maybe catch to the best representation of such things I've ever seen on film in Infinity Pool. The balance between hyper-focusing on something until it falls apart and crumbles, like my own experiences of that would be looking in a mirror on hallucinogens until your skin gets old and you decay, essentially, versus the kind of ignoring the peripheral and allowing weird things to happen. And there's a particular hallucinating scene in this that I felt just encaptured that so much. There's so much focus on quite shocking and strange things, but then also these flashes of moments that you're like, was that, I think I just, so how is it to try and put together a scene like that on paper and then on film and then in the edit?
On paper, it's very easy. Because it's, you know, on paper, those scenes are very short, vague paragraphs that just sort of say, you know, there's a nightmarish sequence of flashing imagery and the image distorts. You know, maybe there'll be an occasional detail that I throw in where it's specific to the script, but tends to be a short paragraph that is kind of code to my team to say, look, we're going to explore and make a kind of experimental film here, and they kind of know what that means at this point. To shoot it, it begins with months of experimentation, usually first and foremost with my cinematographer, Kareem Hussein. You know, we spend a lot of time because I should say those sequences are entirely built with practical effects. There's no CGI in them. It's 100% in-camera practical effects. So Kareem and I will spend a lot of time playing with different gels, types of glass, you know, exploring materials, exploring lenses, exploring lighting tricks and projection feedback and ways that we can deform an image in a practical way. We'll get a kind of toolkit of ideas and a sort of general aesthetic through that kind of experimentation, and we'll bring on Dan Martin is my makeup effects designer. He'll come on and we'll start to come up with puppet ideas and you know, the makeup effects side. Zosha McKenzie is my production designer on Infinity Pool, and she built these sort of mirror boxes that it would be a box of mirrors, inward facing mirrors, but the front mirror is sort of a one way glass. So
without
being reflected. In the back, there's a panel of smart glass so that you can have, we built a rig that's like a pinwheel of light tubes that can spin in the back. Because it's smart glass, it lets a certain amount of light through. So you get the lights, but you don't see the rig or any, it's otherwise reflective, but the light cuts through. So you can get this sort of pinwheel effect where the light reflects around the inside of the box. We shoot a bunch of footage. Then Kareem and I go back to his apartment and we project the footage on a screen and we re-photograph it. You know, sometimes we'll do 16 hours at a time of re-photographing rushes where we're just filming the shot over, same shot over and over again, dangling, you know, dichroic film in front of the lens and diopters. And, you know, we put on this, you know, what I've heard described as a sort of stupid puppet show where we're just wiggling things in front of the lens, but it's deforming the image, and we'll sync up the same shot six times with different kinds of distortion, so we can cut between different versions of that distortion in this sort of glitchy way. And we create an absolute mountain of footage, and there are details thrown in there, like, you know, we'll shoot drops of water and colored water in a tank, mm-hmm. using a probe lens. We'll shoot a kaleidoscope with a probe lens. Dan and Lee Hardcastle did some stop motion animation for us, and then we re-photographed that. So we amass a mountain of footage, then go through the incredibly time-consuming and horrible process of paring that down, taking the best stuff. My editor on this was James Van de Water, and we just spent a truly deranged amount of time editing it, almost at times almost like stop motion, because we were taking individual frames, pairing them, using, you know, three frames from three different shots. But then there's a kind of alchemy to the process, because depending on the order of the shots, different images sort of break through. And so there was a very, very long editing process once we had all that. And that's how we built it out.
You're blowing my mind here. This sounds amazing. And what I love about it, again, I had later on a question about Karim and about the amount of in-camera versus After Effects, because that comes across in the film. And something that's exciting about the way you make this, that I'd felt when watching it, but that makes sense now. After Effects can do amazing things these days, right? I'm not shitting on any After Effects people. They're a key part in so much cinema I love. But because of the nature of their job, they have complete control over everything. Whereas the nature of the way you guys do it, this is essentially a film about people going in thinking they're in control of certain things and not being in control. And those scenes feel so unhinged and uncontrollable, and there's so many intangible things there. And I love to learn that that's now essentially because you built everything in your control and then took all control away, you know, put it through projections, hung thing in front, changed lenses, changed all of this. So yeah, do you feel that the energy in your processes is key? Because it somehow comes across in the footage. The energy going into the processes comes across somehow on the screen and in the work that comes out.
I mean, I think possibly, but not just the energy. I think there are two elements to that kind of practical filmmaking that I think define the quality of the film and that I like. As you say, I don't have anything against CGI either.
Yeah.
It can be great. And we had a lot of VFX in the sense of, you know, cleaning up, you know, effects, pulling out, painting out blood tubes, subset enhancement, switching a sign here and there. And, you know, there are technically VFX shots in the film, but just not for the hallucination effects. One thing is that there's a different quality to a practical in-camera effect. There are limitations too, but I find practical effects have a kind of weight to them and a sort of texture to them. And, you know, it certainly is a different quality. It's something that I like aesthetically. At the very least, you can feel that it's a different kind of thing often. And so that defines the aesthetic to a certain degree. But also there's a process of discovery that isn't possible, I think, at least if you're not an effects artist. Maybe there is a version of that if you're an effects artist, a digital effects artist. But rather than handing something off to somebody and saying, this is what I want, and then getting stuff back, yeah. I'm there wiggling the gels. And you know, Karim and I are exploring. And the thing that happens is you stumble onto this imagery by accident. You know, you're trying for one thing. The effect doesn't work, but it works in another way that suggests another experiment. Or you know, the diopter lines up in just this particular way that you couldn't have expected, and that becomes the language of the film. And so the through process, there's a process of discovery that ends up defining the aesthetic, and that is something that I really enjoy. And I think some of the stuff that we land on wouldn't have been possible if I had just handed the idea to somebody and had an indirect relationship with what they were doing.
Yeah, of course. And I want to know a little bit more about the discovery of the filmmaking process for you and how close your scripts are to what actually ends up on screen. I was chatting to Gaspar Noé at an event a while back, and he was telling me how I think the script for Climax was something like 12 pages. And again, his scripts tend to be, here's an idea, but obviously, you know, he's Gaspar. He's like, people just go, all right, well, you go and do your weird shit over there, and we'll watch it and enjoy it later. So yeah, what's your process on that, script wise to versus what ends up on screen?
I mean, my scripts are not hugely long, but they're long enough. You know, it's I feel like
they're more than 12 pages.
Yeah, they're more than 12 pages. You know, I feel like a good feature length script is probably 70 to 80 pages. You know, but I also direct my pages at more than the traditional minute per page. I don't know why that is. It's just the way I write or the way I direct. But
yeah.
But I know going into it, you know, if I have a 90-page script, it's going to be, you know, well over 2 hours. And so in some ways, the scripting is very specific. I don't do improv in terms of dialogue. The dialogue, I'm very particular about. So on a certain level, it's there. But then again, you know, in this, I feel like from an effects perspective, there's this process of discovery that's very deliberate. From an indie film perspective, there's so much that you sort of uncover through process as well. Just because it's the nature of indie filmmaking, you can't storyboard something and get a bunch of concept artists and then use $200 million to exactly create what you imagined. But I also don't know if that's the best way to make films. I mean, you know, certainly I would like a little bit more money and just, you know, a little bit more time and freedom. But there's so much that you discover when you're doing location shooting, for instance. You know, there's so much you discover as you're exploring a city and going to these different locations, and that they can in a very positive way redefine the aesthetic. And so I'm happy to abandon aspects of the script and conform them to new, better things that we uncover as we're developing. But it's not improvised. You know, it's not a 12-page script and a bunch of improv. It's very specifically scripted.
Yeah, I love that. And you mentioned the location there. And one of the things I liked quite, I was going to say early on, kind of at the midpoint when things start to really get out of hand, is the setting of this story on holiday. Not simply in another country, but people on holiday. Because I think there is something really weird with the mental state of being on holiday, that you can justify things a lot more and you'll do things you maybe wouldn't do in normal day-to-day life. The real world examples are starting drinking in the morning. Obviously, you push that to very far extremes, but it kind of, for me, it helped ground a very obviously wild and surreal series of events. It kind of managed to ground it quite nicely in reality for me. So was the idea of it being in a holiday camp in this kind of faraway land, yeah, a key part of that, of getting to the extremes that you wanted to get to?
I think so. I think you know, a lot of people watching the film have had some version of a holiday at, you know, at a resort, or, you know, on a, you know, not necessarily a fancy resort, but, you know, some of it was drawing from my own experiences at a sort of trashy, all-inclusive resort that I went to 20 years ago. That was a sort of a completely sinister experience for me, you know, from my perspective. There are people who think that's great, and there are people who think it's absolutely horrifying, and, you know, you fall into one camp or the other camp. So, you know, it's not that everybody goes on resort vacations, but there is a sort of... even though these characters are sort of wealthy and abnormal in the sense of being very rich, there's something to the banality of that kind of vacationing that I think is sort of an in for people. People have had experiences similar to that, relate to that. Also, I think structurally, the film, for the first, you know, 20 minutes, is a film that you've seen before. You know, the accident on vacation where people get in trouble film is a common one. And then I think that's also an entry point. Hopefully you feel it's going to be one thing, it changes into something else. As per our previous conversation, I think you kind of know a little bit about where it goes, at least initially, that twist is out there. But starting with something familiar and then transforming it. So, you know, also with Possessor, I mean, it's sort of on a certain basic level, it's a kind of spy film or sort of assassin film, but it has this other element to it. And so I think giving people some entry point in through that allows you to go off the rails in a sort of fun way, hopefully fun way later.
It's what I really like about your films is exactly that. It will have a very familiar entry point or route or general theme, as you say, but then it allows you to go
fucking bonkers with them in places and go to really quite extreme places, and it still, it roots it in everything. But I guess, I mean, I want to talk, obviously we've got a limited amount of time. I want to talk a little bit about me and Alexander and just the cast in general, because what kind of pre-production work goes into a film like this? Because again, some of the scenes that both Alexander and me have to do are pretty out there. They're pretty wild scenes. And Alexander in particular, he just astounds me at the moment, because I think he is this classic Hollywood superstar guy, yet he's continuing to pick interesting projects like this, like The Northman. He's not just going down the typical route that someone of his stature, his physique, his look, his talent could go down. So, yeah, how do you get the actors to the right place with the performances that they have to give?
I mean, honestly, I think with actors like that, they're in the right place coming into it. I think, first of all, if an actor is not right for a film like this, they won't talk to you. I think if you're
speaking, there's clues in the script, right? There's clues in the script if it's going to be for you.
Yeah, you know, like those scenes are scripted, so you know what you're getting into. And if it's not for you, you're not even going to return my calls. But also, you know, the thing is, I cast those actors because they're so brilliant, because I'm already excited about them, because I know where they can go. I know what they can do. And so I sometimes get a question like that, you know, how do you get this performance out of the actor? How do you kind of get them there? The answer is I stay out of their way for the most part. You know, with actors like these, the casting them is the most difficult thing as a director. You cast someone because you know they're going to be brilliant. And then there's some prep work. I mean, we have conversations to varying degrees. I mean, with both me and Alexander about what the character arc was, you know, to varying degrees, we would get into the details of tracking the character, what their motivation would be, the character psychology, those kinds of discussions. By the time we get to set, though, I mean, they're just doing great stuff, and I'm just letting them do great stuff, and they're making my job very easy. I mean, obviously, as a director, you need to be editing in your head as you're shooting the scenes. You need to have a sense of what you want to do and make sure you're getting the right material, so it's not completely free form, but they're going there and I'm trying to create an environment where they're free to go there. You know, it's not a struggle. I think in a film like this, if it were a struggle, it would mean you had the wrong actor. You want people who are just going to absolutely embrace it and take it to a level beyond even what you had in mind.
What's your process in finding those right people? Because it struck me as I was watching this, Mia in particular, I was like, absolute perfect person for this role, obvious person. But then it occurred to me that, well, X and Pearl and things like that probably came out after you've cast her for this. So it probably wasn't, because it does with Suspiria as well. She seems to be the darling of indie horror, of creative, original indie horror at the moment. So yeah, what draws you to people and how does that casting process go on your side?
I mean, I hadn't seen Pearl or X. She was shooting Pearl when I first contacted her. So they shot it back to back with X, and so X hadn't been released yet. But I mean, I've loved her work since the start. I mean, you know, like she's one of those actors I've been seeing for years, and every time I see her in something, she's stealing every scene she's in. She's absolutely brilliant. She just has that hard to articulate, viscerally exciting thing that some performers have, that where you just see them and it's they're making no boring choices. They're immediately fascinating, you know. So again, I think part of it is you select someone very exciting, or this is my stupid casting process. You find someone who excites you in that way, and you plug them into the character, and you want them to wake that character up for you, because I'm very bored of my characters by the time I shoot them developing for too long. Yeah. They've gone to sleep on me, they've died on me, and so I want a character to bring them back to life, an actor to bring them back to life, to wake them up. So you get someone like Alex, you get someone like Mia, the character becomes perfect for them because they're so excellent. they embody that character. And then even as a director, you know, I'm happy if the actor is not exactly what I imagined and if they're surprising me. I don't want the character to be exactly what I had in mind. I want the actor to bring their own art to it and to bring their own genius to it and to catch me off guard and to shape the characters in a surprising way. Then by the time the film is edited and released, I can't see those characters being played by any other actors also. But it's not because I had exactly that in mind when I was writing, you know, quite the opposite. I want there to be some friction between my conception of the character originally and what the actor brings to that, because I think that's exciting. You know, I think that collaborative process is exciting, and that it gives the character that feeling of discovery for me, where through process we're finding something.
I can completely imagine that by the time of shooting, to have that new excitement of this character feeling new and feeling original is going to then draw you in more to capture every element of it. I want to talk a little bit, before we run out of time, about sound, because, again, I think you've illustrated how important the relationship between yourself and Karim is on this in with the visuals. I think with horror and sci-fi, which is where you kind of walk the line, I feel, with both of those genres, more than any other, really, sound designs, soundscapes is so key to the experience of a film. So, yeah, what's the sound process?
It's different on every film, to be honest. I've sort of had different sound designers. I mean, there's a sort of team in Toronto that I've worked with a number of times. But then on Possessor, it was Martin Pavey who, you know, I'd go to his... It was a very different experience because we were doing post in London, and so I was going to his attic in Plumstead, and he's another sort of mad scientist who was sticking contact microphones to my head and playing Jennifer Jason Leigh's voice through my skull and then recording that to get the proper sound through my head. So
astounding.
It's been different in each case, actually. I think the constant is the characters. Each film is sort of from the perspective of one character. They tend to be very subjective films. So I want the experience to have this kind of impressionistic quality to some degree, to have it be, especially in the hallucination sequences, this sort of, like, you know, very first person impressionistic thing. But then music really enters into it as well. I mean, you know, on Infinity Pool, Tim Hecker did the score. It's absolutely fantastic. And the score and the sound design have it because of the way he does music, because it sort of has this sound design quality. And this is there's a lot of the film where the score really takes over, and stuff that might have been sound design actually kind of gets in the way of the music, because the music is already partly sound design. And so there's an interplay there between the composer and the sound design team.
Yeah. I always get a buzz talking to people who are in this industry, who are excited to nerd out over all these weird intricacies and details, and to kind of not necessarily make it easy, because making film is really hard, but kind of consciously going, well, it's going to be a lot harder if we're putting microphones and playing a voice through my head, but that's how we're going to do it. So I want to kind of know, was film always what you were going to do? Obviously you've got a hell of a surname, a hell of a lineage there, so was film always your goal, or were you reluctant at first?
I wasn't really interested until I was in my 20s, to be honest. I mean, I grew up around film, and so I knew what that process was, and I always respected the art form. But to be honest, I was sort of doing everything else. You know, I was playing in bands, and I was trying to write books, and I was doing visual art. And I kind of came to film because there was a moment where I was just doing a little of everything and not doing any of it very well. And I realized if I was going to have any shot at becoming halfway competent at anything, I needed to focus on one thing. And so film wasn't really something I came to as a cinephile loving film specifically. Although again, I always appreciated the art form, but it was a desire to stay connected to music and to stay connected to visual art and writing while focusing on one particular thing that I could hopefully develop a skill for, or you know, some basic competence for at least.
Yeah, well, I think you came in at exactly the right time from what I'm seeing. So to wrap things up, I want to ask what's ahead. I believe, are you working on a TV show next, or is that inaccurate? It's always hard to know if what's true on IMDb. Be or not. So what's ahead?
I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. I am working on a show, an adaptation of a J.G. Ballard novel called Supercan as a series. I hope that's going to happen. I'm, you know, have a space horror film that I've been developing for a number of years. There are a couple of other things I'm not allowed to mention yet, but none of it's locked in yet. So I'm actually not sure what the next thing is, but I hope to have something to shoot in the next year or two.
I was going to say, how do you relax in between projects? Are you any good at relaxing in between projects, or is it constantly a ticking over thing to want to know what you're working on next and what you're creating?
I can't relax at all. I mean, maybe it's because I drink too much coffee. I don't know. you know. Yeah. But it's interesting because, so, you know, film, obviously it's in a sense a freelance job in addition to being an art form. And on the one hand, you can sort of keep your own schedule, I guess. But on the other hand, everyone I know who's in an early stage film career is anxiety ridden and in a state of psychological ruin because you're constantly worried that you're not going to be able to get something together. It takes years to get something together. And so you're always kind of reaching for something. It's very hard to turn off. But that's okay. I mean, I like working. It's a horrible but absolutely wonderful thing. You know, I feel so fortunate to be able to make films for a living. That's incredible. So yes, I don't relax. I think that's okay. I don't know. You know, maybe I'll burn out eventually, but for now I'm happy to just keep going.
Well, I hope you don't burn out anytime soon. And I appreciate you taking the time to come and have a little chat today. I hope the rest of the day goes amazingly.
Well, thanks so much. Yeah, thanks for talking to me. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. I hope you enjoyed that. Because as you will have heard, I did. You know that when he was going into the technical breakdown of how they shot the hallucination scenes and stuff like that, you know I was buzzing. And the stuff about the sound as well, recording sound through his skull. All that stuff. You know I'm a nerd for that. So, yeah, this was a dream. I'll be back next week with more of the good. So, until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.